All right. Thank you for sticking around for Bible class. We will be jumping into the sixth chapter of the book of Esther this morning. Hopefully you're keeping up with us in the book here. It's a really fun book to teach, and I've enjoyed getting more intimate with it this quarter, and Bill and I had a chance to teach this a few weeks ago or a few months ago in the back, and so really enjoying this story and unpacking all that it has for us. Just a reminder, it seems like a nuisance. It seems like maybe it's not worth waiting a few seconds on, but if you have a comment, we have a lot of people worshiping with us online this morning. So if you'll raise your hand, we have two mics floating around, and they'll come and help you pick up the sound, both for everyone here to hear you well as everyone online can hear what you have to say. So take a moment, pause, and make sure we get that mic in front of you. All right. Where are we in Esther? We're in Esther chapter 6. I think I've started off the last few classes with these questions, but it's worth setting the stage. Who is Ahasuerus or Xerxes? What kind of person is he? Awful. Ms. Lucille says he's awful. That's certainly... Well, he was a warmongering emperor. Say that again?
He considers himself a god.
He considered himself a deity, for sure. So absolute power, absolute authority. Did you say bad or rash? Yeah, both, right? He makes rash decisions, often that he himself regrets. Yes, Greg?
Likes to drink a little bit.
He does like the drink. We see him in chapter 1 drinking for 6 months and then having a uber drinking party the last week of that 6 months. Interestingly enough, alcohol is involved. Ego is involved. He likes to satisfy himself. He doesn't like a lot of negative things to even come into his palace. And you can see the hubris pouring out of his every seam here. What about the Jewish people? They're scattered. Some have returned at this point. The temple either just is finished or it will be finished very shortly. That took a number of years as well. And there's still Jews, to Michael's point, in captivity. And here we find these living in Susa, so far away from where they're known to be. And how does the plot unfold? We don't have to go through every chapter and every nuance in the story, but where are we generally with the story? What's happened?
There's a change in the queenship.
Yeah, Esther had a queen. Ahasuerus had a queen, and he put her away. Comment over here, Mike.
Well, and Mordecai has decided that he's just going to kill all the Jews because Haman doesn't salute him as he walks by. Or I'm sorry, flip-flop that.
Yeah, I do that all the time.
Yeah, I did too, but that's okay. And then Mordecai has gone through messengers to the queen and says something's got to happen, or you're going to be a Jew too and die, or you are a Jew and are going to die.
That's right.
And then so she's trying to figure out the best way to handle it, knowing that the king is so rash. She's just taking her time with how she approaches this.
And we see that she knows if she goes unsolicited and he hasn't even asked for her for 30 days, there's a very good chance that if he doesn't move, she's dead. What a proposition, right? Who wants to go into that room tomorrow morning? Not me. And yet she does it, right? She does it, and she goes it. And how does she ask? Yeah, Dan.
She asked Mordecai for them to fast for so many days.
That's a great point. There's an amount of prayer and preparation, making sure that the Lord is on her side the best she can. Yeah, Michael.
And then she asked for a banquet with the king and Haman.
That's right.
That was like her strategy, right?
What's the best way to appeal to someone who strokes their own ego all the time? Stroke their ego first, right? And you can bet there is some drink involved in this as well. So we see a lot going on here. Very crafty, very thoughtful preparation. And we leave Haman feeling pretty good about himself, right? Haman is feeling pretty puffed up. And he's going home from this banquet, and what happens?
Mordecai
again, right? That Mordecai. And he just is so into himself. He just can't get over this Mordecai situation, right? And Mordecai doesn't bow down to him. And he goes home, and who's at home? You can kind of imagine, I think, I don't know, my best imagination is watching the compound when the... This is the best visualization that I have, is when they attacked Bin Laden's compound, and you see these walls. Like, I kind of imagine, so he's going to his compound. Like, this is the second guy in all of Persia, right? It's not just a little mud hut on the side. He's got this compound, and he goes in, and who's there in this compound? His family and the key advisors of the nation, maybe not all of them, but some key advisors are there. His support group, yeah. And what do they say to do at the end of chapter 5? Hang him. Just go and put an end to him. Which is kind of interesting, because if he had just done that in the first place, this whole story might not have ever existed, right? We might have another martyr known as Mordecai, but... he's going to go and make the highest gallows. He's going to put a display. If you don't worship me, if you don't bow down to me, if you don't honor me, you're going to be up there dripping on that spike.
Yeah. John, before we go into content, just how can we not be amazed or shocked by what goes on? Two men have put nations and lives to be killed off of character flaws. And so I look at today what goes on to the world, and we want to throw blame, we want to find blame on what goes on in the world, but yet we see here a historical account of two men and their character flaws have put thousands of lives just as at disposal.
Yeah, and clearly this is a prime case of pride before the fall, right? Is putting yourself up there on a pedestal. We talked a lot yesterday. Mike talked about leadership, and here we have the second in command of all of Persia. Is this an example of leadership? No, it's the exact opposite, right? Where is his focus? It's not that different than Xerxes, is it? It's all about himself. Esther's glorifying me, and Mordecai's not. I mean, I wonder if he knew in that moment that they were cousins. Would that just like blow his mind? I don't know. It's fascinating to get to this point in the story. There's a lot of drama, a lot of tension built in here as we enter into chapter 6. And Haman, you know, here's more good decision-making, right? Haman's been up all night partying with Esther and Ahasuerus. He's probably drunk. He's come home. He's mad. It's 12:30 in the morning. It's the perfect time to make a big decision in front of the empire, right? In front of the emperor. No, this was the same mistake we had in chapter 1, right? Lots of regret comes from these late-night decisions. And maybe there's something to be taken away from that time and reflection brings a lot of wisdom. Okay, so with that, we're going to get into chapter 6. Any other comments? We've laid the stage, maybe overly laid it, but here it is. Maybe don't be drinking all night, but... yeah. Nothing good can come of this. And so much so that he gets up out of his house in the middle of the night still, and he's on his way to talk to the king. So let's read the first five verses here. That night, the king could not sleep. So one was commanded to bring the book of records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Then the king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" And the king's servant who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." So the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman just entered the outer court of the king's palace and to suggest to the king that Mordecai be placed on the gallows that he had prepared for him. The king's servant said to him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So we start off, and the king has a little bit of what? Insomnia, right? And it's interesting. The writers of the Septuagint make it very clear. And this is where we start to see the province is the play, the providence of God. Sorry. I was on a call with them. A group of Canadian coworkers, and I was talking about providence this and providence that, and they were like, "I've just gotten out of Bible class." And anyway, it was their states, you know. Anyway, so the king has insomnia, and the writers in the Septuagint bake in the providence. They say God took away his sleep, and I think that's obviously the story that we have here, right? Even if it's not written so forthrightly in this verse. But he can't sleep, and it just so happens that he thinks of getting the Chronicles out. Why would he get these Chronicles out? Because unless you're Jordan Holland, listening to a bunch of history about yourself or someone else, I've just made a history joke, not himself, will put in about anyone to sleep at 1 a.m., right? You start reading to me about some commanders of the Civil War or something at 1 a.m., and I'll be out. And I think that's what Ahasuerus was going for here. And have we seen these Chronicles before in the story? Yeah, expressly when Mordecai saved the king's life, right? When he came saved Xerxes' life, it was expressly commented that was written in these Chronicles. And it just so happened on this night when Esther has thrown a party and Mordecai has made Haman mad and Haman has come to seek Mordecai's life, that the Chronicles open up, and what they read about is when Mordecai saved the king's life. I mean, the coincidence and the odds of that, just the happenstance of that is pretty outrageous, right? And I think you can begin to see the providence coming through here in this first verse of chapter 6. And it was read, and it was read about that Mordecai had saved the king's life, right? And what does the king ask?
How did we honor
him? How did we honor him? Herodotus wrote, it was actually maybe not law, but severe custom that if you showed honor to the emperor, that you were to be bestowed honor back. And so it was a very natural question for Ahasuerus to say, I didn't hear how we rewarded this guy Mordecai for saving my life. And not just the law, you can see on a personal level, you know, if someone had saved my life and it was years later and that was recounted to me, I think, did I appreciate that person? And maybe we see a moment of a genuine heart here coming out of Ahasuerus. I don't know. But he says, we need to do something for him. Because nothing has been done for him. And what is his idea?
Ask somebody else,
right? He doesn't even have an idea. Someone saved your life and you can't even come up with an idea. You know, apply that context over everything that's happened in the book. Does this guy think for himself at all? I don't know. It seems interesting that he needs advice here. You know, it's interesting. There's more than one small circumstance that has to come together for this to come out. One writer wrote about it. It's among the objects of the writer of Esther to show how the smallest circumstances of life, those most generally regarded as left to chance, work together for good. And as we think about providence through the rest of this book, and as we think about what God does for his people, what is it that we're most often looking for? When we want God's life involved, what is it that we're looking for? God's involvement in our life, what is it that we're looking for?
Direct intervention.
Direct intervention. The big miracle. The obvious path. But what does this suggest God's providence is at most at work in? The small circumstances, is that right? Yeah, I think... certainly the bigger things are possible, but what story does this remind you of in the New Testament? Yeah.
Daniel, maybe?
How so?
I don't know. I mean,
it's not like God came down and built a fortress around them inside of the furnace, and you could visibly see this protection or this plan working out. I mean, it's all metaphysical, for lack of a better term. It's intangible. We can't see it, but it's right there on the tip of your tongue. It's in the back of your mind, and it's an influence in a way to subtly influencing people to make decisions for God's purpose and God's plan.
Yeah. Justin?
Reminds me of the story of Jesus and the way that he was betrayed, the way that he was crucified. And you look at all the prophecies throughout the Old Testament and all the little things that happened that were mentioned beforehand. You know, the way that he died, the casting lots for his garments, the way that he was betrayed, you know, all these little details that, you know, you can gloss over when you're going through the Old Testament, which so many of the first century Jews had done.
Yeah.
But then when you go back and look at it, and it all kind of starts to piece together, and you see all the intricate details that were laid out before time, and God's hand moving through the people of that time to see all this to play out the way that it did.
Yeah, maybe this isn't God's providence, but it's also, we see stories like this with Naaman, right, where he wanted the grand gesture of repentance, but he was told to go wash in the Jordan, and he found that degrading. It's in the little things that I think we most commonly see God working in our lives, and we don't take anything away from these verses. I think Justin's right, is we always want to find God in the big, momentous occasions, but he's also there working in the day-to-day tweaks.
Also, even looking at our own lives, I don't think that all of us have had an instance to where really providence of God entering in is not something you see right then. You look back on what has happened and how it unfolded. What it may have brought you into contact with, you know, what work you were able to perform, and it's always that's bringing it forward. Oh, okay, that's got to have been the providence of God that's done this. So it's all, even in our lives, it's looking after the fact, looking back at what happened and went, that's why it happened.
Yeah, that's a great comment. It's that tapestry thought where you, as it's being woven, you might not see the picture, but that color change, that slight little thing that happens over and over and over, comes together for this great picture of God's deliverance and salvation. Any other thoughts about that?
Sorry. So I think the point that you're making about God is not always in the big events is perfectly lined out in 1 Kings 19. Elijah just got through this battle of on Mount Carmel with all the prophets of Baal, and he goes up on the mountain by himself, and there's a fire and an earthquake, and God is not in either one of those things. He's in the whisper. And so I think that's a perfect illustration of exactly what you're saying, that God is not always in these massive, huge events. Sometimes he's in the finer details, and it takes being quiet and listening to really get the point.
To be clear, God can be in the big things. God can speak the world into existence and has the power to do anything with his creation that he wants. But I think it's worth taking a moment and recognizing his working in the little things as well. All right, so we see this indecision on the part of the king. He needs to find a way to reward Mordecai. And so who does he call on? Can you just imagine Haman? I mean, he's maybe still drunk. He's pacing in this court. He's getting ready. I mean, he may be thinking he's about to have to walk in and wait for the scepter. You know, he may be having to make the same decision that Esther did, although he has a lot more hubris. He might have had more confidence than Esther had in the beginning. And nonetheless, here he is pacing in the court, but which, by the way, there's enough language written here that is very descriptive about the king's chambers and where he would have been sleeping and reading and things of this nature. This all makes sense. And there was this outer court, and then there was a door, and you stayed along the outer side until you were summoned or ready to go in. And so, anyway, it's interesting that this all works out.
Well, from verse 6, it's pretty clear that Haman heard what was going on. It wasn't just like he was out by himself. He heard this discussions taking place, and he's sitting there thinking to himself, got to be talking about me, you know. So what good things can I bestow when it talks about whom would the king delight to honor more than me? I mean, he's obviously hearing these things from what I'm gathering and thinks, well, he's got to be talking about me. What greatness is he going to be able to do for me?
So let's go ahead and read 6-9 here. So Haman came in, where Mike was mentioning. Haman came in, and the king asked him, "What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" Now Haman thought in his heart, "Whom would the king like to delight to honor more than me?" I mean, this whole day has been about him and the king, right? And Haman answered the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe..." Sorry. "Let a royal robe be brought, which the king has worn, and let a horse on which the king has ridden, which has the royal crest placed on it, and which has the royal crest placed on its head. Then let his robe and horse be delivered to the hand of the one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. Then parade him around town on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" So Mike's already made the point. He thinks this is about him, right? If there was any question about hubris here, I don't think there is anymore. But we see maybe a level of immodesty here, right? Immodesty can take on a lot of forms. Haman was so vain, it was so much about himself, that when this question was asked of him in the middle of the night with the king after he's being brought in, he can't even fathom that it might be, not even forget Mordecai, about anybody else in the entire kingdom, right? Yeah, do you have a comment, Brian?
My hand wasn't raised. Oh. Yeah, I do. I can't help but think of...
I can't help but think of Jesus' words on love, that we are to love our neighbor as ourselves. And ironically, in this instance, Haman's love for himself is so great that he bestowed the highest honor upon somebody he didn't love.
That he hated. Yeah, his arch-nemesis, if you will. Man, what an abrupt turn, right? Here in the story, Haman's got the favor of the emperor because of these shekels and taking down the whole Jewish nation and being in this party and like that. It's upside down. And to Brian's point, this is absolutely the opposite of how we're instructed to behave. What do we think about his hubris here? I mean, Brian started to unpack this a bit. Let's look over in Matthew chapter 23 for a second. Whereas it was really hard to make application at the beginning of this book, it starts to have lots of places where we can tie in and bring these lessons home to our day-to-day life. 23, 1 through 10 here. Then Jesus spoke to the multitudes, to his disciples, saying, "The scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to do, to observe, that therefore whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do, but do not according to their works, for they say and do not do. For they bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. But all of their works they do to be seen by men. They make their phylacteries broad and enlarge and the borders of their garments. They love the best places at feast, the best seats in the synagogues, greetings in the marketplaces, and to be called by men, Rabbi, Rabbi. But you do not be called Rabbi, for one is your teacher, the Christ, and you are all brethren. Do not call anyone on your earth Father, or one who, for one is your Father, he who is in heaven. And do not be called teachers, for one is your teacher, the Christ." I mean, the middle of this text is basically the Jewish version of Haman, right? They want the acclaim. They want the honor that's coming from everyone else. And in fact, everything they do is to seek out this acclaim and honor. And I think, that's a temptation for all humans, right? We want to be accepted. And that can take to a very monstrous form, in which we see in the Pharisees, in which we see in the likes of, frankly, Xerxes and Haman in this story. Another verse in Romans 12:10, "Love one another with brotherly affection, outdo one another in showing honor." Can you imagine if Mordecai and Haman were working together? They had this much prowess and this much influence on the nation, what they could have done. If this is just the opposite, right? And this is something that we can take to heart from the story, is rather than show honor to ourselves, rather than think about ourselves first, think about everyone else ahead of our own needs in our lives. Any thoughts before we move on? Yes, AG.
I think it's just interesting through this whole thing how sin blinds a person so greatly that they cannot even see past them, their own self and what they want. Like your point earlier, he could have probably had Mordecai killed at any time, but he makes these elaborate gestures to get this done. We're going to kill a whole nation over this, and then I'm going to build a big gallows to kill this person because I want everybody to know that I have taken care of Mordecai, and here we go again. Oh, it's about me. I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to get all the honor, and I think it's going to be, it's interesting, and it doesn't tell this about how, at the very end, how does he feel when he has to honor Mordecai in all this?
Yeah. It's a sweet moment in the story, isn't it? It's very tasty. I think you're spot on, H.E., and maybe if we have a few minutes at the end, we'll read from John chapter 3. But even John the Baptist, who probably in Christendom deserves some acclaim, closes a paragraph by saying, "He," meaning Christ, "must increase, but I must decrease." And this, again, is just the opposite instruction of everything we see going on here. And so what does he ask for? He wants basically for it to be known that I'm the king's little brother, right? I may not be the king, but I got everything else. Everything else I can touch, I can do. I even want to wear the crown, right? I mean, these aren't just like nice gifts. These are symbolic images of power and opulence and control in the kingdom. And again, he thinks it's all for him and is going as hard as he can to get those things for himself. And any thoughts about these gifts or the parade that we haven't already touched on? Yeah, Ian.
Do we know, is he saying here, taking the king's horse?
Yeah, at least one the king has ridden.
Okay.
I'm sitting in the seat where the king is set. I'm wearing the clothes the king has worn.
Yeah, that would be like, to my knowledge, you know, nobody sits on the king's horse. Like, that's his position and his position only, so... I keep picturing like the sheriff of Nottingham here, like he's trying to play king and do everything for everybody to think of him as, you know, the highest power, kind of like unbeknownst to Ahasuerus here, like, because he's kind of oblivious to what's happening. He's drunk all the time. He's making rash decisions. He's not really connected with what's happening in Persia. It seems he's pretty disconnected. The fact that this guy is clearly seeking to be, he's seeking to have the highest amount of power he can.
Yeah, good thoughts there. Okay, let's read verse 10 and 11 here. Then the king said to Haman, "Hurry, take the robe and the horse as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai, the Jew who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken." Let's stop there for a second. Can you imagine the look on his face? I mean, you have to be pretty controlled. This guy doesn't like any negativity in his throne room, right? And you have to keep your poker face, but can you imagine the twisting and uncomfortable change of heart that this guy must be having? Like, maybe a pit in his stomach doesn't explain it. I mean, again, what a tasty change of events here.
John.
Yeah, Mike.
In today's world, we can see him sitting there saying, "Are you kidding me?"
That's right.
You know, so even though I might not show it, those words will indicate real quick what my thought process
That's
is.
That's right. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That, man. This had to be a scene here, and he probably had to say, "As you wish, Your Highness, you know, Your Excellence." Oh man, this is a rich part. Verse 11. So Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai. He had to put it on himself, right? He arrayed Mordecai and led him through the city square and proclaimed before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Again, just more of this humiliation, right? Let's look back in chapter 5 real quick. What was he saying? His wife and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows be made 50 cubits high." So I know that's high, but he wants to send Mordecai to a very low place and put himself on a high place. "And let Mordecai be hanged on it in the morning and go merrily with the king to the banquet." So that was his plan, and the exact opposite has happened, right? In fact, he's had to put Mordecai above himself. And we saw this a little bit in that passage in John 3. But are there any other passages in the New Testament that talk about this?
About what?
This concept of... he wanted to put himself up high and ended up being made low.
You know, the person at the banquet sits up towards the head, gets pushed to the bottom, and it sits at the bottom.
Yeah.
The
first shall be last. Yeah. I think it's spot on, right? I mean, what you see here is even the apostles vying for the right hand. And they want the same acclaim and the same honor, maybe not to the monstrous form it's taken in Haman, but they want the same thing. And Christ says, "The last of you shall be first, and the first of you shall be last." And that's clearly played out here.
And the Lord gave instructions for how we should conduct ourselves in these situations when he said, if you go to a banquet, you don't take the first seat, you take the last seat. And then if the president of the banquet comes and elevates you up, then you have pride rather than taking the high seat.
And is that natural? Is that easy to do? It's counterintuitive, right? It's contrary to who we are as humans, at least in our most natural form. Albert and Lee both have a comment here. Lee first, Albert says. See, he's putting
me first. Nice. I think it's interesting that, and I had never really considered this much. In verse 10, it says, the king says to Haman, hurry, take the robes, as you said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew. So King Ahasuerus knew that Mordecai was a Jew. You look back at the story when Haman presents the idea for annihilating them, he doesn't ever say the Jews. He just says, there's a people living among us that are problematic. And it says the king hands him his signet ring, and then everything else that's written about the decree is, it was written in the name of Ahasuerus, and it was signed with the king's signet ring, which meant that Ahasuerus might not be as on the hook as I always thought he was.
And you're unlocking a ploy for the last two or three verses here. I think that was very intentional on Haman's part. We'll talk more about that in just a second. Yeah, Albert.
The bell rang. Go ahead.
Oh, we got 5 minutes, I think, right?
No? So, in talking, you see, and as the subheading in my Bible says, Christ's triumphant entry, you know, he had specific gone in what he wrote in on, and how it was embarrassing to the Jewish people of this time, and that here's our supposed king that everybody is proclaiming from an earthly standpoint, and he's coming in on, you know, on a donkey, and they wanted him to be on a horse. So just years later, they're still, you know, they had adopted to what was noble and what was great, and to ride in on a great steed would be the proper thing for a king to be riding on, but Christ put himself lower. So,
as you say that, it strikes me, to do something like that has to be intentional. It's not our natural response. You have to stop, think, and put yourself last. Maybe it may be a comment on Christ's behavior there at the end. All right, verses 12 through 14. Afterwards, Mordecai's feeling great at this point. Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends and everything that had happened to him, his wife's men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. So the king sends his second in command to go honor this man Mordecai, utterly annihilating the ego of Haman. And he comes back home, and his wise men say, and his wife says, what? You're done. And I think Lee's onto something here, because what is the most realistic explanation of his undoing is that he hasn't told Ahasuerus who the people is, and once the king learns that it's Mordecai, and nobody's done any detective work because it's really easy to tell Esther's related to Mordecai in this story. Once he learns it's Mordecai that you're trying to kill, you're done for. You've done the secret thing, and once it's unpacked and Mordecai's involved, you're going to at best lose your influence, right? And so they kind of, and maybe there's more here. There's some thought that maybe just the gods were not working in Haman's favor at this point, in which they all took a lot of importance from those kinds of signs and those things. And maybe just there's some of that here saying, yeah, the tides have turned and you're not going to recover here. And what a twist in this story, right? And he doesn't even have time to mope and depress. He gets this terrible, you know, these people probably fed him what he wanted to hear most of the time. And then he finally gets this terrible news from them, and what happens? He's got to go turn it on again, right? Because he's about to go before the emperor and his queen for another banquet. Come on now. He just gets, I mean, you ever feel like life just doesn't stop until you go to sleep? And then this guy's been up all night. He's been in the king's chambers. He's been parading Mordecai around. And now he's exhausted and has to go put on a best face in front of Esther. And I mean, with someone like Haman in your way, is there a better state to catch this guy in to overcome him? Not really. He's exhausted. He's tired. He's frustrated. Yeah, Justin, one last
question. We know that Mordecai had directed Esther to not reveal her heritage before she became queen. Do we have any evidence that either Xerxes or Haman would know her heritage? It doesn't seem like they know the connection to Mordecai.
If they did, there's no way this story would be playing out this way, right? Would the king choose to get rid of the Jews if he knew Esther was a Jew? You think Haman would put his queen, his boss's queen, in jeopardy if he knew that? I think we'll see further in the story, it's pretty safe to state neither of them were aware. Yeah. All right, chapter 7 on Wednesday night.
Thank you.